Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this 27th day of April, 2024. I'm your host, Mark Call, and as it turned out, it was a really busy week for news. I guess we're getting used to that. Good news is that we're at least still seeing some reporting and that we're still able to talk about it here. The bad news is that so much of it had to do with literally the destruction of a once free nation and its replacement by an out-of-control communist regime. Whether you want to call it fascist or just plain tyrannical is almost immaterial at this point, but one thing's for sure, they've destroyed the rule of law and the judiciary almost completely. But towards the end of the week, we got at least a glimpse of whether or not that has yet taken full effect. And I'll spend most of the second segment talking about that aspect. Meanwhile, though, let's start back at the beginning of the week and take care of some of the other items that kind of led up to it, starting with what I've been calling the weekend coup, this last weekend's coup, during which the Congress committed an open act of treason and literally told the American people to go F themselves. And that, folks, honestly, is being as kind as I possibly can, given the level of perfidy that these outright whores have demonstrated over and over again, but are now getting to the point where they rub people's noses in it. Oh, yeah, and they did that, too. After the vote on Saturday, they got out little Ukrainian flags and waved them and said, hey, we love Ukraine's borders, but as for you Americans, we're going to bring in the invaders and to hell with you and your houses and your futures and your kids. Haven't you figured that out yet? We are traitors. And yeah, I'm still a little bit peeved about it. And this, remember, is after they consigned the Fourth Amendment to the trash can and confirmed that not only, no, we don't need no stinking warrant, we're not even going to pretend to worry about due process anymore, as if that wasn't obvious from watching, say, the state of New York and conflicted open whores in Atlanta and Merrick Garland and the Department of Just Us and so on and so on and so on. Oh, yeah, and the rigging of the election. Do you really still think they're going to bother with that? And that, folks, was just a brief bit of what happened, at least allegedly, over the weekend. And that's on top, of course, of a continued attack by Israel on Iran and the IRCG, or Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, actually in Iraq, that more than a few sources are saying may well have been an American operation. Anyway, there's a surprise, right? Who could imagine such a thing? It's kind of like the only people in the whole world they aren't attacking are the invaders coming in via the non-existent southern border. As Hal Turner's radio show put it in his coverage, is the U.S. openly now trying to foment a war between Israel and Iran? He thinks the answer is yes and asks, what better way to do it than attack Iranian assets inside Iraq one day after some type of so-called attack inside Iran yesterday, which could at least be viewed as Israel having done it. But just maybe, he suggests, and he's not alone. It could be that the U.S. is fomenting all this trouble. They want war, and that should be obvious, because the occupation government in the swamp is broke, and $34 trillion in debt that they cannot pay will come due very shortly, and they're not even going to be able to service the interest on it. And while you've certainly heard this before from sources like your host, Hal Turner adds, they need a big war so that when they financially go completely belly up, they can blame that financial collapse not on all their profligate spending, outright lies, and treason against the American people, but on the war instead of having the blame placed where it belongs, on them for literally printing money out of nothing until they destroy the entire country from within and from the bottom up. Clearly, he says, the ultimate goal seems to be a direct, not even proxy anymore, war between the U.S. and Russia. And ironically, folks, China will be the ultimate benefactor. And guess who's pulling a whole lot of the strings? And then particularly, he continues, and I think this, folks, is the kind of thing Americans had better face up to while they still can. This will, if they get their way, be the kind of war where nukes get used by both sides. And then, once a number of big cities on the U.S. coasts are vaporized, they can slither back out from their bunkers like the snakes they are, telling the creditors, oh, poor us, our cities are smashed, all of our people are dead, our economy is in utter tatters, we need debt forgiveness. And that debt will have to be forgiven if you understand anything about actual economics, because there's not a chance in hell of it ever being repaid. Mathematically, it's impossible. And the same people who caused the whole mess will then get to start the you-know-what show all over again and still be in charge. Thank you, continuity of government and our dual system of justice, where treason is rewarded and patriotism gets you thrown in the gulag. And this is certainly a related story. It came out Monday. A judge on Monday declared a mistrial, which shows you just how idiotic some of them are, after an Arizona so-called jury — it wasn't really a jury at all, folks, but they got about as close as one of them gets nowadays — was unable to reach a unanimous verdict in the murder trial for the Arizona rancher named George Allen Kelly, who was on trial for his life for simply trying to defend his life. His property on the southern border was invaded. This, by the way, wasn't the first or even the 100th time. And ultimately, an invader was killed by somebody. The persecuting state was clearly unable to prove who that might have been. But they have made their point. By making an example of someone and demonstrating that you no longer have the right to defend your property, much less your country, against invasion, says the piece in the Gateway Pundit, jurors deliberated last Thursday and were unable to reach a verdict. So deliberations continued Friday, and after another 7 hours, the jury sent a note to the judge and informed him they could not reach a unanimous verdict. Now, here's the problem. Back when we had what was called trial by jury, and as most of you know, we're nowhere close anymore, haven't been for decades, if not the better part of a century, that would not have been called mistrial. That would have been called what it is: not guilty, because the prosecution failed to make the case. If you can't get a randomly selected, and they're no longer that either, jury of this man's peers to say unanimously and beyond any reasonable doubt he's guilty of murder, well then guess what? He is, by definition, not guilty. That's the point of a unanimous verdict. It's not so that a crooked judge can say, oh, if you can't find him unanimously not guilty, we're going to keep going until we select enough malleable morons that we can get one. And we'll just keep trying, because while it's his life that's on the line, we're still drawing our paychecks and sleeping in our comfy beds. And I guess if we have to, they think, we can find some morons in New York who'll convict anybody if they say he's MAGA connected. And I know what some of you might be thinking. No, they can't do that, Mark. They can't try him in New York. The Bill of Rights says they have to try him in the state and district wherein the crime was supposedly committed. Once upon a time, they called it the Sixth Amendment. And guess what, folks? If you haven't been paying attention, that was gang raped years ago. Remember a guy named Tim McVeigh? They didn't try him in Oklahoma, did they? Too many people there wouldn't have drunk the Kool-Aid. But just look where we are now. So, just in case you missed it, let's connect a few dots over just the last couple of weeks. The Congress says, screw the entire concept of the Fourth Amendment. We don't need no stinking warrant. You don't have a right to say no. And if the NSA wants us to force you to tap your own phones and electronics, we're more than happy to do the dirty work for them and then shield them from any possible prosecution for crime, like we just did Alejandro Mayorkas concerning his aiding and abetting of the invasion across the southern border. Well, what was left of it. Speaking of which, we got 10,000 or so invaders a day that have been coming across that non-existent southern border, many of them acknowledged to be either terrorists, gang members, drug cartel members, smugglers, rapists, murderers, or the potential candidates for Congress, while literally thousands of others have joined up with their cells and their military outfits, be they Hezbollah, the Taliban, other Islamic Brotherhood state members, North Korean or Iranian military, who knows, probably more than a few Russians in there, or, no doubt the top draw, the Communist Chinese Party, People's Liberation Army, embedded in the continental United States. And you already know, as they did last week, that when the FBI starts telling you to be afraid, be very afraid of the coming terror and cyber attacks, it's way too late already. But also over the weekend, we had a reminder on this front. Big Brother and his minions of Satan who walk in men's shoes intend to charge and jail pretty close to 2,000 patriots, those who decided that they really wanted to petition their government, whether it was advisable or not, for a redress of grievances against the rigging of the 2020 election and theft thereof. What they got instead was a long trip to the gulag, destruction of their families, their personal fortunes, and, yep, what was left of their country on top of it. Now, here's the irony, folks. 2,000 Americans and counting headed for the gulags, and how many illegal invaders have been charged and tried for, say, murder, rape, and real insurrection? You know the answer. Less than the number that have recently committed high-profile murders and gotten away with it. Lincoln Riley was hardly the only one. And it turns out, folks, although you almost certainly will not hear from Western so-called news media sources, that contained within that latest bit of treason in the House and Senate was another time bomb destined to destroy, say, many people, and that would include your host, what's left of the almighty fiat U.S. dollar. But the headlines from sources like RT and TASS, as well as certain European sources, aren't nearly so sanguine about what's been done to the almighty dollar. Contained within that bill was a provision targeting Russian assets that are being seized as a result of it by the United States. Now, this has been talked about. They've known it was coming for a long time. That's why Russia and China and the BRICS nations have been preparing for it, because essentially what the stories are now saying is that this is yet another shot across the bow. And the BRICS nations are taking note that if Big Brother can seize Russian assets, well, why can't they seize any other assets that they blankety-blank-and-well want to? And the answer is nothing prevents them. So guess what? Time to abandon the dollar while the getting's good. And that seems to be the upshot from so many of the sources, again, outside those that are being reported within the captive American media. And this update from Lena Petrova that came out over the weekend is not only pretty succinct, but pretty blunt and very much on point.
Now that the West, thanks to the United States initiative, is moving forward with confiscating Russian sovereign assets held in foreign banks, the entire world is going to push for de-dollarization. Why? Well, because they understand that if their foreign policy is not aligned with that of the West, they will be sanctioned too, and they will be treated in a similar manner, if not worse. The US dollar is a weapon that nobody will want. It has already become a foreign policy tool, which is precisely why foreign central banks are stockpiling gold month after month for years.
That's true, folks, and we've seen the big moves up in gold recently. And among the reasons for that are what's going on with these sanctions against Russia. Actually, asset theft is the proper way to phrase it, and the destruction of the dollar, of which BRICS is a big part, but again, only a part.
The U.S. House of Representatives voted in favor of confiscating, or stealing, I should say, Russian frozen assets. Now, I'm waiting to see what the United States Senate decides early this week, and I will definitely share an update here on my channel.
Let's be real, folks. Anyone want to place a bet now? Guess what? The international markets already are.
Well, this year, Russia is the chair of the BRICS bloc, whose main focus is to develop an alternative to the SWIFT financial payment system. Once the BRICS system is fully launched, we should expect de-dollarization to accelerate, since none of the payments that are settled between China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, for crude oil, for gas and other natural resources, as well as settlements between other bloc members, none of that will be made in the United States dollar. The BRICS countries overtook the G7 countries' share of the GDP in terms of purchasing power parity back in 2020, 4 years ago. And by 2023, the difference had increased even further. The BRICS now is holding a total of 32% of the world's GDP compared to 30% held by the G7 countries. Once these countries launch an alternative system, the United States dollar status as a global reserve currency will be threatened directly in no time at all. I will remind you that once the petrodollar is gone, it will be over.
Which may help explain why the deep state, including the white whorehouse and the whoring Congress, are so anxious to destroy it completely before that becomes too obvious. Which means it's time for a bit of comic relief, even if, ultimately, it's a bit of Freudian truth to boot. The Biden Fuhrer was lining up a storm in Florida for his latest gaffe. Okay, as of midweek anyway, for actually in this case, double gaffe, after refusing for a bet about the satanically given right to sacrifice children to Moloch. If you haven't figured it out, folks, it's a sacrament to the DNC. It's also really profitable to be able to harvest baby parts in the name of reproductive freedom. He questioned just how many times the former president, the actually elected president Donald Trump, needed to keep on proving that we can't be trusted. Ha ha. Yeah, he really did say it.
In a sense, I don't know why we're surprised by Trump. How many times does he have to prove we can't be trusted?
But it's the fact that it was a Freudian slip that I think should have attracted more attention than it did. Most of the coverage, including international coverage, just calls it the latest gaffe. For example, the India and Hindustan Times both said, in his latest gaffe on the campaign trail, Biden questioned the, quote, number of times Donald Trump needed to prove that we can't be trusted. And as a result, it says many trolled Biden in the comment section of the above video. But don't worry, folks, Congress is now telling the NSA, you go get 'em, and they will. With one user saying, and this is really the point, folks, always telling the truth, unintentionally, of course. You see, this really is why they have to have speech and thought controls. And another said, what I will suggest is obvious. Can anyone name One time Biden told the truth about anything? Said another user, sure, I don't think he has to prove a thing. He's doing quite well proving that all by yourself, Joe, you can't be trusted. Likewise, Fox News in their coverage says that Biden was mocked for admitting we can't be trusted, and everybody pretty much says, yep, we agree, Joe. Internationally, folks, it's increasingly obvious the United States is a laughingstock for having a double-diapered, senile, incompetent, masquerading as supreme leader. Well, what was most interesting to your host, folks, was the Daily Mail's coverage, which says ABC News, almost alone, still thinks you're stupid enough to drink their Kool-Aid. ABC News, they noted, tried to cover for the man masquerading as president, replacing the word we with he when they described the speech, even though all of us clearly heard him say, we can't be trusted. So we clearly includes ABC News, as well as the White House official spokeslayer. But you notice, folks, that up front I did say double gaffe, so there's at least one other highlight in this thing we need to point out. Could it have even been another Freudian slip? Because it doesn't have quite the same aura as his other Alzheimer's-like gaffes. No, he was telling the truth. It just kind of slipped out because he no longer has the self-awareness to know when he's supposed to stifle the truth and push the lie. He's in Florida, of course, pandering to nutcases who believe that the Supreme Court has the ability to override the Constitution. And when they declare that a God-given right doesn't exist, that's true. But on the other hand, when they declare that something that isn't a right at all, like, say, the right to murder, somehow is, that's called making law. The TV cameras, of course, prominently featured a bunch of idiot women, all of them no doubt fully vaxxed and boosted and immunocompromised as well as sterile, and they were probably intellectually compromised before they took the poke. Waving pre-printed signs that said, Restore Roe, and then JoeBiden.com at the bottom. And they heard the senile teleprompter puppet shriek and wail about what he called the, quote, cruelty and chaos associated with the entire concept of allowing a fetus to actually come to term. Trump, he claimed angrily while waving his Hitlerian fist, tries to take credit for the Dobbs decision.
He described the Dobbs decision as a miracle. Maybe it's coming from that Bible he's trying to sell. Whoa. I almost wanted to buy one just to see what the hell's in it.
And as revealing as that first gaffe was, folks, how many times does he have to prove we can't be trusted? Answer, it doesn't matter because you'll keep lying anyway. That second one, and I have no doubt he actually meant to say it, is perhaps even more damning. So a brief recap is in order. First, Trump, as you probably have heard, because the left stream just hates the concept of a politician having anything to do with the Bible, they've had a hissy fit about it ever since it came out, especially if he's using it, admittedly, at $60 a copy to fund a campaign that they absolutely despise and want to make sure is almost a stillborn of the things they want dead via abortions. Anyway, it's a special edition called the God Bless the USA Bible, based on the famous Lee Greenwood song. And not only is it the King James Version of the Bible, but it includes copies of a bunch of historical documents, including the U.S. Constitution and Declaration of Independence. In other words, it's almost everything the left hates so viscerally, except Trump himself, between two leather covers. And I guess this is apropos. In a 3-minute video advertisement that was released by the actually elected president, when he introduced the Bible, he said, concerning those documents that are included along with the scriptures, many of you have never read them, meaning the Declaration of Independence or Constitution, and don't know the liberties and rights you have as Americans, he said, and how you're being threatened to lose those rights, unquote. And while he may be a bit late to the party, folks, that part is true. And what's really interesting is, let's hear what the Biden Fuhrer had to say about the whole concept of a Bible and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, because it really should resonate. It's about more than just killing babies.
He described the Dobbs decision as a miracle. Maybe it's coming from that Bible he's trying to sell. Whoa. I almost wanted to buy one just to see what the hell's in it.
And whether he's talking about Scripture, or the Bill of Rights, or the Declaration of Independence, obviously, that, folks, is about as true as anything you'll ever hear out of the lips of this traitor.
I almost wanted to buy one just to see what the hell's in it.
And did you notice the laughing sycophants? They don't know what the hell's in there either. But they hate it all anyway. As you might have gathered by now, folks, a lot of the news today seems to be meta news. News about the news, or at least about the frauds, the cover-up, the destruction of the rule of law, the deep fakes, all the big lies that people have been fed for so long that at least slowly are beginning to come out. And it's interesting to see what the reaction is as they do that. Here's a piece, for example, from Zero Hedge that says, newly unsealed documents and yet another persecution of Donald Trump. The classified documents case here revealed that the Biden Fuhrer and the fake White House colluded with the National Archives and the federal bunglers of investigation, well, at least they bungle them when it comes to the leftist occupants of the White House, to concoct a case against the actually elected president. Journalist Julie Kelly, they say, has been all over this. And she writes that thanks to the order from Judge Eileen Cannon, key evidence related to the classified documents case has now been unredacted. In other words, what the Department of Justice and the evil Jack Smith wanted to conceal. You know what, folks? Every time I see a picture of this guy in one of these articles, I cannot but wonder if he looks more like a serial killer or a child rapist. Maybe both. And from the right side of the equation, now we know why. More proof of collaboration, she says, between the Biden White Whorehouse and NARA, the National Archives, to try to concoct a case by whatever means necessary. What's more, special counsel sick Jack Smith sought to conceal all of this, telling Judge Eileen Cannon in February that Trump's counsel isn't entitled to discovery about documents concerning collusion between the White House and NARA, and the court should just toss requests for evidence of any alleged coordination, and that the court should deny Trump's request for evidence related to secure facilities at his residences. Further, Trump's request for unredacted discovery of any materials that would actually be, well, once upon a time, important to say things like the Sixth Amendment should be denied. You peons, you don't have a right to trial by jury. You don't even have a right to due process. You sure as hell don't have a right to see the evidence that we have against you, whether we made it up or not. Writes Julie Kelly, to clear up any confusion as to what the so-called special counsel Jack Smith sought to conceal, when it comes to the classified documents case, this, she writes, is what Smith told Judge Cannon in February 2024 in response to Trump's motion to compel discovery from a bunch of government agencies. Defendants are not entitled to, well, and after that, just fill in the blank. As the Epoch Times notes further, the trove of unsealed filings also revealed that the Federal Bureau of Investigation, SIC, i.e. the FBI, and their code name for their investigation into the elected president's presidential records was redacted. But the part that they will allow you to see is plasmic echo. I can't help but wonder if the first word they don't want you to see there might have started with an F. The defense has argued that the emails unsealed on Monday of this week indicate communications between NARA officials, the Biden-Fuhrer regime, and the DOJ, SIC, regarding President Trump's records alleging coordination in targeting the former president since at least 2021. One email from NARA's general counsel to the National Archivist discussed drafting a letter to U.S. Attorney General, SIC, Merrick Darth Vader Garland, concerning missing Trump records. Subsequent emails revealed coordination between the National Archives and the White House Counsel's Office regarding the handling of those records. And essentially, email after email reveals coordination between the NARA General Counsel, Gary Stern, who'd been in touch with both the DOJ and the Biden White House, as if there was any difference about the issue, and subsequent emails reveal that the White House Counsel's Office is, quote, now ready to set up a call to discuss the Trump boxes. All the while, folks, the Biden Fuhrer had a whole bunch of stuff in his garage that he wasn't even entitled to declassify. But you know it, don't you?
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
And it goes on and on, but furthermore, says the story, the defense highlighted instances in which various NARA officials didn't bother to disclose certain actions to Trump's representatives, suggesting, can you believe it, some bias in the so-called investigation, or the framing process. And as Julie Kelly points out, more new info from the unredacted evidence in the so-called classified documents case shows that within just 24 hours, who could have imagined such efficiency from government workers, within 24 hours of their having received 15 full boxes of stuff from Mar-a-Lago, they were able to produce an assessment. Some might suggest they had it ready already. And as, well, more and more people that have looked at the evidence here are pointing out, it is a quote, fucking clown show. Unquote. Given the importance of what we're trying to look into here and the fact that they're obviously trying to rig an election, says the piece, the defense, along with a coalition of news media, has asked the court to unseal all of these exhibits and documents, arguing that the court filings are, quote, matters of public record. And the filings made public on Monday revealed previously sealed information while limiting the redactions in order to keep secret the names of the government perpetrators or witnesses. Which takes us to the break, and we've got a lot more after that. Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening, folks. I am again your host, Mark Call. And as I noted up front, it was a very busy week for the news, but ultimately, there is one story that I want to wrap things up and summarize the week with today. Because this one really does deserve a deeper look. It had to do with oral arguments before the Supreme Court in the latter part of the week regarding President Trump's immunity case, where the deep state is basically trying to find any and every excuse for making sure this guy is never, ever allowed anywhere close to the Oval Office again. And yeah, if they can, they'd like to jail him, maybe even kill him, but they'll certainly be able to do that in jail. They're working on getting rid of his Secret Service protection, too, which is part and parcel of the same process. Well, the arguments were interesting, and there was certainly no shortage of hype and pre-spin leading up to what happened on Thursday. But in 2.5 hours of oral arguments, at least a bit of the smoke surrounding the situation may have begun to clear. And Zero Hedge's summary seems to be pretty good. They said reading the tea leaves of the comments has left most believing that SCOTUS will fail to grant President Trump the full immunity now that he's left office or was kicked out that he's seeking, and then choose instead to narrow the protections for former presidents, but they're likely to at least issue a ruling that could further delay his so-called trial on charges of conspiring to overturn the obviously rigged, but they don't have to address that issue, 2020 so-called election, which would be at least a partial win for the actually elected president. And even Axios is reporting that a definitive ruling against Trump and a clear rejection of his theory of immunity, they note, would allow the bogus January 6th insurrection trial to promptly resume. Well, that's probably the least likely outcome. And in your host's opinion, these seem to be at least pretty solid takeaways. Now we'll get to some of the quotes and questions that buttress that point in a minute. A majority of the justices seemed inclined to rule that former presidents must have at least some protection from criminal charges, but not necessarily the absolute immunity that Trump is seeking. The core distinction, though, during oral arguments, came down to a president's official versus unofficial or private actions, and which of Trump's efforts to overturn the, clearly bogus 2020 election rigging results were official versus unofficial. And the most likely outcome might be, and this fits, folks, because they generally tend to not have a backbone unless it's so clearly obvious that everybody would ridicule them for not having one, which certainly is on the table. Thank you, Justices Kavanaugh, Alito, and Clarence Thomas. Anyway, the most likely outcome seems to be one way or the other for the High Court to punt, perhaps by kicking the case back to lower courts, even including the scumbag U.S. District Court so-called judge and Obama sycophant Tanya Chutkan, for more hearings, i.e. do it all over again. But at least that'll probably happen after the next rigged election. The UK Daily Mail's coverage notes that the Supreme Court justices at least raised the prospect that they may now want to design a new test to determine whether a president does or doesn't get immunity for official acts in a process that could easily throw off the sham Fedsurrection trial. The clues there, they said, came in a series of questions from members of the court's conservative majority who wanted to know what presidential conduct was public versus private and whether there were sufficient guardrails in the current so-called judicial process, whatever that may be, to protect a real president from excessive prosecution. Quote, "You also appreciate that we're writing a rule for the ages," said Trump-appointed Justice Neil Gorsuch in one of the several indications, says the Daily Mail, that members of the court were contemplating some type of new balancing mechanism, a ruling that could task lower courts with sorting out the details of exactly what conduct is deserving of protection. And such a move, they note, could prove calamitous for special counsel and chief inquisitor Jack Smith, who has repeatedly urged courts to move on with haste. Don't take time to look at what we're trying to accomplish here, and especially don't try to look at the constitutional implications, because if you delay, we won't get away with it. Even urging the Supreme Court to expedite its actions following a so-called win at the appeals court level months ago, which put the January 6th sham on hold, at least temporarily, after Trump's lawyers raised their claims of immunity from persecution and persuaded an appeals court to at least hear it. Nixon v. Fitzgerald has been mentioned during these proceedings. That was a Supreme Court case from 1973 that established that presidents enjoy absolute immunity from civil liability for actions that fell within what was called the outer perimeter of their official duties. An expert speculated to the Epoch Times that the justices could decide to extend that same framework to criminal liability. Notes the zero hedge coverage, this is the second major oral set of arguments that the justices are hearing about attempts to punish President Trump for winning the 2020 election and then openly talking about what was so obvious, not only statistical impossibilities and multiple open violations of state law, but any number of ways that the fraud has been since then revealed and now certainly documented. They heard oral arguments, you may recall, in February over Colorado's attempt to disqualify him from the state's ballot by the utterly bogus 14th Amendment insurrection argument, and even the pretty much anti-constitutional leftists on the court joined the opposition to that obvious sham. During the process, justices like Samuel Alito noted correctly that the president is in a, quote, peculiarly precarious position, and, said Brett Kavanaugh, another Trump appointee, this case has huge implications for the presidency, for the future of the presidency, for the future of the country, unquote. And on that score, folks, he's right on. Now we'll start our deeper look with the president's attorney, John Sauer, from Missouri's opening statement.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Without presidential immunity from criminal prosecution, there can be no presidency as we know it. For 234 years of American history, no president was ever prosecuted for his official acts. The framers of our Constitution viewed an energetic executive as essential to securing liberty. If a president can be charged, put on trial, and imprisoned for his most controversial decisions as soon as he leaves office, that looming threat will distort the president's decision-making precisely when bold and fearless action is most needed. Every current president will face de facto blackmail and extortion by his political rivals while he is still in office.
Which we saw, folks, and he doesn't point out that were this to happen, the United States would descend rapidly, if it hasn't gone there already, into banana republic status, where anybody who takes over, by coup or otherwise, the existing government simply goes and executes all of their rivals who were once in power. And we're virtually there.
The implications of the court's decision here extend far beyond the facts of this case. Could President George W. Bush have been sent to prison for obstructing an official proceeding or allegedly lying to Congress to induce war in Iraq? Could President Obama be charged with murder for killing U.S. citizens abroad by drone strike? Could President Biden someday be charged with unlawfully inducing immigrants to enter the country illegally for his border policies?
Of course, it's worthy of note that in this case, Biden actually encouraged those illegals to storm the border even before he put his hand on a Bible and lied.
The answer to all these questions is no. Prosecuting the president for his official acts is an innovation with no foothold in history or tradition and incompatible with our constitutional structure.
Note, by the way, and he doesn't mention this, at least not here, that Bill Clinton was correctly impeached for perjury, among other high crimes and misdemeanors, which is the right process.
The original meaning of the executive vesting clause, the framers' understanding and intent, an unbroken historical tradition spanning 200 years, and policy considerations rooted in the separation of powers all counsel against it. I welcome the court's questions.
From there, let's take a look at least some of the highlights from the question and answer session. I encourage people, watch as much of that as you can stand. And there was certainly so much good and, oh, incredibly bad that it's almost difficult to know where to start. But certainly one that seemed to see through the ruse was Samuel Alito. He was probably one of the standouts. As it turns out, even people like Kavanaugh certainly expect Clarence Thomas to be able to see through it. Even Chief Justice John Roberts almost managed to give the impression that he not only saw through the lawfare, but might even be willing to stand up to it. And I saw some really good analysis from the War Room with Steve Bannon, and his commentators put it this way. A lot of these justices seem to be seeing through the game. They weren't buying it. They were recognizing the BS. There is a lot of truth in there, but what frustrated me, and I guess I expect folks to see this as well, and maybe Alito especially and Clarence Thomas were kind of aware of the elephant in the room. You can see they certainly saw it. They didn't come right out and say it, but maybe they figured the American people would recognize it, and they didn't have to. There was some back and forth about protections and immunities and things that literally don't exist anyway if we don't have a constitution, which was the underlying but not overtly expressed theme here. Constitutional law professor Jonathan Turley summarized it in a live stream, something like this. Chief Justice Roberts, he wrote, asked the most poignant question. Well, I don't agree on that, but anyway, what if, he said, a president appointed an ambassador, a clearly official act, but does so for a bribe? Like, say, the guy that we know that's sitting in the Oval Office did now, repeatedly, but before he was in the Oval Office. Sauer offered a nuanced point that the bribe itself would not be an official act, whereupon Justice Sick Sotomayor hit Sauer and said that Trump was only acting for personal gain and not in the interests or in the function of his government. What a crock. What a piece of work she is. She was making, says Turley, the slippery slope argument that such immunity would protect the assassination of a president. Here's the quote. If the president decides that his rival is a corrupt person, and that part at least is true, folks, and not hypothetical, and he orders the military or orders someone to assassinate him, and remember, Trump didn't do that, but we are certainly seeing a parallel right now. Is that within his official acts for which he can get immunity, unquote, said the leftist Justice Sonia Sotomayor, to which Sauer argued, well, that would depend on the hypothetical, unquote. And said Turley, Sauer agrees that a president can be prosecuted for private conduct, but his point is only that the motivations of official conduct should not be the function of the inquiry of the court. So, said Turley, he's doing a good job in maintaining a more nuanced position before the court. And then Justice Jackson got embarrassed by Trump lawyer John Sauer when she tried to describe an America where the president has the kind of immunity that the scumbag who stole the office obviously has now. And she missed the point of her own joke. And that's worth coming back to, and we will in a minute, but first I want to get to the continuation of this thread. Because, said Professor Turley, and interestingly, Justice Alito seems to have answered Sotomayor on her hypothetical in dealing with the term plausible. And he exposed the flaws and the fraud in the D.C. court opinion being used against Trump after the special counsel attorney claimed that grand juries are layers of protection for the president. What a crock. Noted Alito, humorously, yep, there's an old saw about indicting a ham sandwich that some of you have probably heard. And there were whole strings of hypotheticals thrown around. Ironic, folks, given the real situation that we find ourselves in today with an unelected criminal in the White House who's observably senile and at best incompetent to boot. Concluded the Daily Mail's coverage, these queries were all meant to challenge Trump's broad claims of protection for acts taken as president while he is in fact facing criminal indictment, bogus as it might be, folks, over his so-called election overturn effort. And amidst all the questions about what constituted official versus private acts of a president, Justice Gorsuch summarized it thusly, quote, I'm not concerned about this case, but I am concerned about future uses of the criminal law to target political opponents based on accusations about their motives, unquote. And Chief Justice Roberts made this point, slamming the lower court's opinion that, quote, a former president can be prosecuted for his official acts because the fact of the prosecution means that the former president has acted in defiance of laws, unquote, to which Roberts responded he's concerned about that because it sounds like, quote, a former president can be prosecuted because he's being prosecuted, unquote. Justice Brett Kavanaugh asked what I think is one of the more pointed questions. We all remember how Barry Sabarco, or whatever name he's using today, was particularly filled with hubris when it came to his expertise as a murderer, saying he was particularly good at killing people, referring to his drone strikes that killed at least one innocent U.S. citizen.
How about President Obama's drone strikes?
And just listen to the load of self-serving BS that followed that question.
So the Office of Legal Counsel looked at this very carefully and determined that, number one, the federal murder statute does apply to the executive branch. The president wasn't personally carrying out the strike, but the aiding and abetting laws are broad.
In other words, even if it looks like murder for hire, we've determined that he's above the law.
And it determined that a public authority exception that's built into statutes and that applied particularly to the murder statute because it talks about unlawful killing.
It's lawful. Why? Because we say it's lawful. So
did not apply to the drone strike. So this is actually the way that the system should function. The Department of Justice takes criminal law very seriously.
Just two words here, Merrick Garland.
It runs it through the analysis very carefully with established principles. It documents them. It explains them. And then the president can go forward in accordance with it. And there is no risk of prosecution for that course of activity.
There's especially no risk of prosecution when we decide what the law is and when or if it even gets prosecuted. Which leads me back to something we've touched on before, and this clip, featuring one of the most idiotic women ever to put on a black robe, much less claim to be a justice on the Supreme Court, Ketanji Brown Jackson, the woman who, remember, doesn't even know what a woman actually is. And note, before I do this clip, she got confirmed by the Senate, so what protections do we have from idiocy in high places? Her own perfidy here makes the point.
Which will...
No, I'm also... Let me put this worry on the table. If the potential for criminal liability is taken off the table, wouldn't there be a significant risk that future presidents would be emboldened to commit crimes with abandon while they're in office?
Duh. Look at the guy who wasn't even elected and is committing crimes now. But wait, he was committing crimes from bribery up to and including treason before he even got installed in the Oval Office.
It's right now the fact that we're having this debate because OLC has said that presidents might be prosecuted. Presidents from the beginning of time have understood that that's a possibility. That might be what has kept this office from turning into the kind of crime center that I'm envisioning.
But is either too blind or corrupt to see when it's staring her right in the face?
But once we say, no criminal liability, Mr. President, you can do whatever you want.
Like has already been going on for 3 years or more.
I'm worried that we would have a worse problem than the problem of the president feeling constrained to follow the law while he's in office.
So, if you listen carefully, you'll see that she just summarized, although I don't think she's smart enough to recognize it, the Biden regime and what's been going on.
But once we say, no criminal liability, Mr. President, you can do whatever you want.
Kill American citizens like Obama did, jail them without trial like we've seen here, order them to take lethal injections, keep classified documents in your garage next to your Corvette. Oh yeah, and let's not forget, destroy America from within and sell it out to the highest bidder.
I'm worried that we would have a worse problem than the problem of the president feeling constrained to follow the law while he's in office.
Let me
put this worry on the table. If the potential for criminal liability is taken off the table, wouldn't there be a significant risk that future presidents would be emboldened to commit crimes with abandon while they're in office? It's right now the fact that we're having this debate because OLC has said that presidents might be prosecuted. Presidents from the beginning of time have understood that that's a possibility. That might be what has kept this office from turning into the kind of crime center that I'm envisioning. But once we say, no criminal liability, Mr. President, you can do whatever you want, I'm worried that we would have a worse problem than the problem of the president feeling constrained to follow the law while he's in office.
I respectfully disagree with that because...
He was too respectful because all of us can see she's a moron.
I respectfully disagree with that because the regime you've described is the regime we've operated under for 234 years. There has not been an expectation based on 234 years of unbroken political...
All right, let me ask...
And here, even though he gets interrupted, Trump's lawyer actually got the dates wrong, too. Because it turns out there haven't been 234 years of unbroken, politically peaceful transfer of power. Obama threw away the key when he basically did not allow Trump to take office. All of us saw Russia, 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 including wiretaps, the Steele dossier, and other overt acts that make a lie of the peaceful transfer of power argument. even before he entered the Oval Office, starting with Operation Crossfire Hurricane and the destruction of his national security advisor, General Michael Flynn, right off the bat. And by the way, I enjoyed the fact that people like Professor Jonathan Turley took note of Justice Jackson being embarrassed by a stupid question and by Trump lawyer John Sauer's response when she tried to describe America where the president has immunity, and he said, quote, "The regime we've described is the one we've operated under for over 234 years. Present company accepted, of course. One of the other elephants in the room that I do want to deal with briefly is a question that was asked about whether or not, if an attorney general advises the president about something, does that constitute a claim of absolute immunity? Is the attorney general advising the president that something is constitutional? Does that constitute an absolute defense? Well, if his name is Merrick Garland, you know that the guy hates the Constitution, and he doesn't give a damn what the Constitution says, whether it's the Bill of Rights or anything else. We don't need no stinking warrant. We don't care about foreign invasions. We certainly don't want people like Alejandro Mayorkas to be held up and tried for treason, now do we? But we're more than happy to throw thousands of Americans in jail for trying to exercise what were once called First Amendment protected rights. The elephant is in the room here is they're pretending to ignore the fact that if there ever was a president that deserved to be indicted while in office, he's in there now, but he doesn't even have a legitimate claim on the office. So, of course, the constitutional remedy, and we're not going to see this exercise, is to first impeach the president for what? Constitution says it, high crimes and misdemeanors, and then, once he is convicted, then... And I guess if they really cared about the rule of law, they'd do it while he was still in office, or at least begin the process. Then, anyway, having stripped him of immunity by means of conviction in the Senate, well, if we still had one, and admittedly, that's pretty much a moot point now, too, proceed further. Because ultimately, the question is America, have we made the entire leap to hyperspace and become a banana republic? Trump's legal team's argument is, in the vernacular, in a banana republic, the new guy comes in, and the new guy executes the old guy and accuses him of crimes committed while in office. And that is essentially what the left is trying to do. They're coming in and they're saying, look, we stole this election. We stole it fair and square. Our guy's committed bribery and crimes against humanity, and our guy's been, literally selling out the country, and our guy is continuing to do all kinds of things that if we had a constitution would still disqualify him from ever being seated. We know he put his hand on the Bible and lied, but we're going to ignore all of that. The point is, we're going to go convict this other guy who was in the office before of doing things that were bad, like documents that he had every power to declassify while he was sitting president. And remember, by the way, that Biden, when he was vice president, did not have the power to declassify documents that were later found, but basically ignored, sitting next to his Corvette in his garage and a whole lot of other places. Oh, yeah, and remember Hillary Clinton's server that was on private property with all kinds of top-secret information, evidently and provably being sold to the highest bidders? Because, hey, anybody that had the keys could come in and get it. Neither of them were president at the time. Both wanted to be. All of those are crimes, real crimes, but one of those that was elected president is actually being prosecuted. The others aren't. So here, folks, is ultimately what your host considers is the most important thing that came out of this, and it basically boiled down to a pretty bold admission by the scumbags for the deep state. As Orwell put it, famously, some animals are more equal than others, and as the deep state puts it, well, if you're doing our bidding, then what you're doing is lawful. If you're not, we will come and get you. We'll kill you if we can, and don't you forget it. We will redefine the law. And that's what they're doing here. They're saying the law is what we tell you it is, nothing more, nothing less. Presidents that follow the law, in other words, those that do our bidding, they're okay. But anybody that doesn't, we'll hang them. Doesn't matter whether they're in office or out of office. Doesn't matter what the Constitution says. Doesn't matter whether there's a statute or not. That's what they're showing with Trump in New York. We're going to just make things up and call these misdemeanors, even after the statute of limitations expired, we're going to call them felonies because, hey, we want to get him. So here's the question. This is Samuel Alito, one of the better constitutionalists on the court, who destroyed, says the piece from the Gateway Pundit, DOJ prosecutor Michael Dreeben with one question. All right? And essentially the question was this. If the president gets advice from the attorney general that something is lawful Is that an absolute defense? In other words, if the president, this is called a reliance defense in law, the president is supposed to say, the attorney general can tell me what the Constitution says. You'd think some of them would be smart enough to read it for themselves, but honestly, I don't know that we've had one of those in decades. That includes Trump, sadly, but it especially includes people like Biden who read the Constitution and then say, the hell with it, I'm going to turn it upside down, especially when it comes to shall not be infringed or the right of the people to peaceably assemble, that kind of thing. Anyway, if the president gets advice from the attorney general that something is lawful, is that an absolute defense, he asked Rieben. And here's the answer. Yes, I think that it is. All right, here comes the 1-2 punch from Alito. But won't that give presidents incentive to be sure to pick an attorney general who will reliably tell them that it's lawful to do whatever the hell, and I put that in there, whatever the president wants to do, if there's any possible argument in favor of it, said Alito. And he nailed it, folks, because the elephant in the room is we know that that's exactly what's happened with the scumbag that's in there now, Merrick Garland, who basically says the law is what I say it is. If we want to attack people, we will. If we're paying attention, at least it's kind of interesting that they're coming right out now and telling you not only what they're doing, but what they intend to do, which certainly gives the rest of us a lot of clues as to what we need to pay attention to.